sharpness geeks, and purveyors of stabby goodness. Welcome to the Knife Freak Show. My name is Jonathan McNeese. This is my co-host, Mr. Chase Boatwright.
Howdy-ho, neighbor.
That's a throwback. Yeah. Hope everybody's doing good. Had a great week. Have you?
Yeah, pretty good. Got a lot done this week, surprisingly. But
good. That's good. It helps when stuff's going. You said you got your oven back up and running. Did you get your grinder?
Yes, grinder and oven good. Are back up and running, and even my wife's car is back up and running. So, yeah.
Hey, there you go.
Fairly productive week. It was interesting.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yep, that sucks. It really sucks when stuff tears up, and stuff always tears up leading up to a show, it seems like. So.
Yeah, I mean, but yeah. Like I said, I think I may have said it last time that I got my oven back up and running in like 10 minutes, and then the grinder wasn't much at all. I just had to basically replace the top arm of it and, you know, put it up there, and I was back up and rolling and got, you know, real tracking again. Because I was just using a bolt with a Allen key stuck in it and going back and forth, and I kept going too far.
Right.
And the nut kept falling off, and it was a
thing. Yep.
But then all of a sudden, the spring pops up, and the belt comes rolling off at you, and, you know.
Yeah, not a lot of fun. That sounds back like you almost like you was working with a Franken grinder or something there.
A little bit, you know, but you do what you got to do in the meantime. I mean, I ground.
That's right. Put a little duct tape on it and keep the wheels rolling.
Yeah, I think I ground 3 blades on it when it was like that. And, you know, I did all sorts of other profiling. I set locks. I, you know, did other stuff too. So, I mean, it worked. But
That's right. It ain't got to be perfect as long as you can keep rolling.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah.
Well, speaking of, you know, stuff tearing up before a show, that's kind of the first thing as far as newsworthy or whatever to talk about is we keep mentioning it every show, but it's just because, like, for us, that kind of consumes our lives typically. I know especially for you, it's, you know, because, like, for us, we're still rolling and sending out stuff to dealers and selling stuff on the website and stuff in the meantime, but I know for most individual makers, it's, you know, it's pretty much all consuming. Like you get within a month of the show and that's probably basically all you're working on is show knives. So
pretty much. Yeah. I mean, and it's tough to try to, you know, walk that balance of like, you know, there's no money coming in and, you know, I'm still having to, you know,
I was just about to touch on that.
Bills don't stop. And, you know, just because Blade Show's coming and, you know, like,
that's right.
You know, I've got to make knives for the show. I've already made the commitment. I've already got, you know, hotel, I've already paid for the table, all this other stuff, and you know, like
it's definitely some delayed gratification. Like you know it's going to pay off, and it, even if it doesn't pay off necessarily at the show, you know, it pays off long term by you know the exposure and all that you get from the show. I mean, a lot of times you don't get the actual benefit from the show for months afterward as people that were there, you know, start coming back and end up buying something like months down the road or something like that, or you know, or they're spreading the word about what they saw or what the knife they bought at the show, and then 2 or 3 of their friends come back and buy something, you know, a few months later, whatever. You don't really, it's good to sell the knives at the show, but the real benefits of a show don't show up until quite a bit later. So that's something else people don't understand. So and guys, on that note that Chase was talking about, and it's true, I mean, even to a certain extent for bigger companies, but of course they're able to absorb it a little bit better for individual makers that are leading up to a show. Like you said, like he's having to work for essentially a month to, you know, without collecting any money basically. And while all the bills still have to be paid. So, and there's things, you know, the only other real way around that I see is to start working on your show knives way in advance, which is fine if you have, but I mean, some of these shows are so close together that you basically, you really can't.
That's
but even if you do, I know for me, it was always, I kind of wanted to take like my newest, greatest thing or whatever the show. So like, you know, if you start too soon making stuff for the show, well then by the time you end up getting ready to go to the show, you're like, well, I'm not even making those, you know, I've already made a change to those by now or something like that. You know what I mean? So it's kind of tough.
Yeah. But I mean, that's sort of how I used to do. Like January to June was Blade Show prep, but I wasn't necessarily, you know, shutting down production for 6 months. I mean, except for Blade Show knives, I would, you know, I was working on Blade Show knives and then working on other stuff and, you know,
back. You just mix them in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe pull one out of a – that's what – I always had good intentions. I never was real good at it of like, you know, like you said, start early and then start, you know, taking like one out of each batch or something and setting it back for the show. But,
yeah,
again, you're trying to get your creative genius flowing and stuff for a show and all that, and it's just kind of hard to way easier to say it in theory than it is to do in real life to actually, because, again, you're trying to come up with special stuff for the show, like your best stuff. Like it's hard.
Yeah.
So on that note, guys, keep in mind that, again, especially for the individual makers, if there's ever a time like leading up to a show and like you've got a maker that you like to support and maybe, you know, they've got non-knife stuff for sale, like swag, you know, shirts, hats, whatever, any way that you can support them, you know, especially like the month leading up to a show,
yeah,
is a great time to, you know, support them and help them out, you know, and I know a lot of, if you're going to the shows, usually customers are saving their money to, yeah, go. There's also tons of customers that wish they could be at a show and maybe aren't getting to go. Well, you know, that's a good time to pitch in and help out a little bit. I mean, it's not like you're, you know, buy a cool hat, buy a shirt, buy something that, you know, you kind of been thinking about or wouldn't mind having anyway. That's a good time to just go ahead and do it and help the guys out. Cause
it definitely helps.
It for sure makes a difference. So that, and also on that note, you know, on the business side of things, that's another good note for individual makers too, to make sure that you have other things available that you can make a little money off of, mm-hmm, besides just the knives, because that can put you in a bind quickly.
Yeah,
so
I need to do a better job of that and keeping, you know, I need to put t-shirts up on my website and stuff like that. And sometimes it is hard to find the time because, you know, it's especially once, you know, you start getting into this grind of, you know, I'm working, you know, I don't even know. I don't want to count the hours. It would make me feel bad, but you know, like once you get into that sort of stuff and, you know, you're the only person doing it, it's, you know, hard once you come in for the night, be like, oh, I've got to list some stuff on the website and do this and do that. Right. And, you know,
it's kind of all consuming. Yeah. If you can, you know, again, back to planning ahead, you know, if that's number one, just try to, you know, I think it's a good idea to keep that kind of stuff available all the time as much as possible. But then, you know, if you know you got a show coming up before you get started on the show knives, go ahead and plan ahead and have some stuff like that ready to go and already on your site or whatever so that you can, you know, it's not going to make a huge difference, but, you know, $20, $25 shirt here, $30 hat there, it does help for sure.
Yep.
So, all right. Well, that's the other thing that we kind of had in news was hit a little close to home, which is that we did go ahead and announce what we were going to do for the new model that we kept hinting at over the last few weeks here. So I posted a little video of the 3D model on Fusion, you know, so I could show it kind of opening and closing and that kind of stuff. Still doesn't really give you the full, it doesn't, you know, you can't get the scale, the scope of it from Fusion exactly on a screen like that. But yeah, it is going to be the Dixon, one of the first, that was probably the third, technically, I think the third, no, actually it may have been the second. I think that was the second model that I designed.
Really?
I designed the F-Muck and I believe the Dixon was second because it was the first one with a spotty hole. And then I believe the Killer Bee was right after it. So yeah, it was my second ever design. It did evolve a little bit, which it had evolved some from the very first ones anyway.
Yeah.
But this iteration has evolved some to include changing we're not using the actual spotty hole because it's, I've already had a couple of people ask about that. I would love to have the spotty hole in there, but we changed it to more of a kind of a rectangular-ish, swoopy rectangle, I guess you'd call it, hole because the licensing agreement with Spyderco does not allow for production knives. It's for custom makers and it's limited to like 50 pieces a year, and it's great that they even licensed it in the first place. I've always loved that they did that. I've always, you know, enjoyed working with them. And like, I wouldn't, even though I think technically their patent on it or whatever has expired at this point, I'm still not just going to claim open season on that and use it, you know.
Yeah.
That's their thing. I'm totally fine with swapping it out. So we did change it, and I wanted to show, well, I showed that video, but for the people that are watching on YouTube, and if you are just listening and not watching on YouTube, this is one of those times where maybe you should be on YouTube. I was going to show you guys the 3D printed model so you can get a little better idea. It's hard for me to hold the blade. It doesn't have a stop pin or anything to hold the blade exactly where it's supposed to go. So this is actually one of the modifications I made on it was to scale it up a little bit from the original Dixon. So the blade's about 3.75. It may actually be the actual cutting edge, may just, you know, say from the where the cutting edge is going to end up right there at the front of the chore or the tip, maybe just be just a fuzz under that. So you can see what I'm talking about with the hole there. Mm. And what I was looking at with the hole, and let me get this lined up right here so it will look right. So that's essentially what it will look like in the closed position. I may have it just a little off.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to tell on the screen. So the hole will line up kind of like that with the little scoop in the frame. It could possibly change some when we get some actual real, you know, metal models going,
yeah,
prototyping. Then if I don't like the way it feels or whatever, we'll tweak some of it a little bit and change it. But I think from what I can tell from the 3D model that it's gonna work pretty well. So
yeah, I'd call it more like a shield type hole, not necessarily like traditional, you know, like slip joint shield, but like,
yeah. I hadn't thought of it like that, but I see that now. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so for the size comparison, guys, let me find my camera again. So this is a standard Mac 2, 3.5. Ah, come on, camera. Here we go. Sorry, guys.
It's harder than it looks, but yeah.
It's way harder than it looks. All right, the camera's in front of me, but the screen's over there, so yeah. I can't. All right, and the microphone's blocking it. So it's considerably, it's not huge. I don't think it's actually as big as it kind of looks in the video there, but it's considerably bigger than the.
And that's a 3.5, guys, by the way.
Yeah, that's the 3.5 Mac 2. So,
yeah.
People, I'd already had quite a few people pretty consistently asking for a bigger version of the Mac 2. Mm-hmm. So I figured since we were doing a new model, I'd just go ahead and start with a little bit bigger version of it. I'm fairly confident that we'll end up with probably a 3.5 to 3.25 and probably a 3-inch version of the Dixon before it's all over with.
Yeah.
But we're going to start off with this slightly bigger version. And it's very similar to the Mac 2 in regards to the blade to handle ratio. As you can see how close the tip comes to the end of the handle right there. Like you can't pack much more blade into a handle than that. Not into this handle at least,
yeah,
without reshaping something. So it's got very similar blade to handle ratio as the Mac 2. So yeah. I'm pretty excited about it. I'm actually planning on, after the podcast here, I'm planning on building the first pallet to run some handle, prototype handles. So we have handle and blade blanks in here, and with a whole bunch of luck, we may have one mocked up minus the bevels and stuff and not heat treated, but just like mocked up to take to Texas to show around, let people get a feel for it and get some feedback. So
yeah,
I'm not
excited to see
not that. Ready to say we will yet, but with a lot of luck, we might. So
yeah.
That's
super cool. I'm excited about that. I mean, I know I've had people reach out to me knowing that, you know, we're friends and stuff, be like,
right,
when is he ever going to do the Dixon? And I'm like, well, you know, maybe someday, but you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, that's not my job. You
yep.
know?
Right. Very soon.
Yeah. So I'm excited to see that. And I know that was one of the models I was like familiar with before I even started working for you, you know, and
right.
So always one of the ones.
It was definitely one of the ones that I made more of as a custom and stuff too. I mean, partially just because it was popular. So
yeah,
I'm very excited about it. The, I forgot where I was going to go with that. But anyway,
on the theme of last time talking about names, did you want to share that or?
Yeah, well, it'll come up eventually anyway, so I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so when I named, so this was, like I said, this was like the second design that I designed, which would have been back in, I don't know. I could probably look back through some of my pictures and stuff and nail it down a little more, but I want to say it was probably 2009, 2010-ish when I designed it. It's probably like 2010 when I made it, maybe even 2011, somewhere right in there. And, I had just gotten into watching The Walking Dead. And like I went through and watched the first season, and then I saw how good it was. And now this was the original, you know, I mean, keep in mind, like it's, I think it's kind of gone, you know, jumped the shark a while back now. But at the time it was new, it was super cool. I watched the first season, and then by the time I got done with the first season, I think that was right, the second season maybe wasn't out yet or whatever. Anyway, got my family to watching it too. We went back, all started together. We were all watching it. So the first few seasons we watched it all together. And of course, you know, we were all big Daryl Dixon fans. I mean, he was the redneck, you know, superstar of the apocalypse.
Yeah.
So that, and then I kind of had like the duel like that and the Mason-Dixon line kind of in my head, but primarily after the Daryl Dixon character on The Walking Dead. So yeah, that's where it came from. That's dating the design of the knife quite a bit, because like I said, that was, you know, I mean, the character's still around, but was back when it was brand new, huh?
I thought Daryl died.
Oh, maybe so. Spoiler alert for me, because I haven't watched it in multiple seasons.
I saw the first episode of The Walking Dead. I haven't seen another one since. I liked the first episode. Yeah. I just never got into it. All I know is, I ain't going to say the line, but because it'll make me have to hit that explicit tag. But I know one quote from The Walking Dead, and that is it from the first episode. So, but I thought Daryl had gone, but I could be wrong.
He may have in recent years. When I quit watching it, which was a couple of years ago, it was he was still around. So I think they even have like a spinoff or something with him in it or so. I don't know. Anyway, the viewers can surely somebody. I'm sure there's some people that hate the show and some that love it out there. So they can chime in and let us know in the comments. But anyway, that's where it's got its origin. Watching the show with my family, and we all thought he was a cool character. So that's where it came from. Yeah. So
I just figured, you know, since we were talking about the naming thing last time, that would be a thing to share.
Another example of me basically naming it after a knife after something random that.
Yeah,
that
I mean, you know, inspiration for pop culture, music, you know, whatever. It's just, you know, whatever works for, you know, different makers and stuff. So.
Right.
But yeah.
Yep.
Sorry, were you going to say something?
No.
Oh, okay.
That was it.
All right. Well, now that we've gone through that, wanted to kind of talk today a little bit about the blurring lines between customs and production knives. And we kind of mentioned a little bit of that, I think, last time as well. And the lines are very, the waters are very muddy out there these days.
Very muddy.
And it's, you know, I consider myself a custom maker, but I don't even know what that, you know, when people hear custom knife maker, they think they can, you know, sketch something on a napkin and come bring it to me and, you know, I'll make that whatever. But so, I mean, handmade versus, you know, full on production like Spyderco versus small batch production, what you do versus, you know, mid tech, like where you're getting some parts outsourced, still grinding and still, you know, sort of doing the custom process. And like, there's just a lot to it. And there's so many different ways that people do these things these days, and they sort of cross over methods in a lot of ways where,
but yes, you're totally right about the, like, and I think it even goes so far too, is like, it goes into the methods that people are, because there's people now that are making quote unquote custom knives or whatever, but they're using CNCs that almost crosses over into like, it's, you know, you could call it like a one man production shop almost, but that's not really accurate, you know?
Yeah.
And we all kind of have different perspectives on it. I think largely based on number one, people inside or outside the industry are kind of, you know, are more familiar. Like you were saying, people coming to you wanting you to make something completely custom. For most people that are, you know, serious knife people or whatever, they pretty much understand that custom in this world technically means it's basically the same thing as handmade, that you're making, you know, making knives. They're all at least to some extent one off, because you really can't make them exactly the same, even if you want to with handmade methods. So it's handmade and custom are kind of synonymous to my way of thinking, at least with in our world. It's just, you know, I know they're technically not custom if you're not building them specifically.
Yeah.
And, you know, and some people still do. I mean, when I got into it, the big thing was people had lists, people had books, and everybody had a book, and you would get basically on somebody's book, and then you would get certain options. Now, it's not like they were building a design that you came up with.
Yeah.
They would be building you, like, say, my Dixon. Like, somebody could get it on my books for a spot, and then they would have options of, you know, you can get the Dixon with this blade material. You know, you can have these options for the handle, you know, stuff like that. It's just, it's basically you pick from a series of options and kind of customize your build.
Yeah.
And that makes it a custom.
Yeah.
You know, but then that kind of carried over into, you know, a lot of guys, myself included, would get to the point where we were basically just, you know, I got to the point where I was done with books, which most people have moved away from too. That's just not a real great business model for most people. So got to the point where I was basically just making stuff and then selling it. You know, I wasn't making it to spec for a customer. I was just making whatever I wanted to make and selling it. So they were technically more just handmade knives than customs in reality at that point.
Yeah.
But maker's choice. The name just kind of stuck that you were custom knife maker versus basically you had factory and you had handmade / custom. And there wasn't a whole lot of in between.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was pretty much it. And then guys started coming out with mid-techs. And I believe Ken Onion was the one that came up with the nomenclature for that.
Yes.
Which I could be wrong, but I think that was essentially basically. So let's back up a little bit. So there was a point where there was a huge argument. This was a little bit before my time in the industry, where there was an argument even for people like calling stuff handmade. Like if even somebody using a water jet, much less a CNC, was like caused this big fallout, like in some of the associations and everything else. So like even people just outsourcing and having parts water jet cut at one point was a big sticking point.
Yeah.
And then people moved into starting to use CNCs and stuff. And so that's kind of where the line started getting blurred. Before that, I think it was pretty much, you know, handmade, either, you know, call it custom or handmade, whatever you want, but it was, you know, it was either all done by hand basically, or it was all, you know, it involved machines, which was considered factory or production.
Yeah.
And so when people started, you know, using water jet and then CNCs and stuff, the lines started getting blurred a little bit. Then mid-tech came along, and my understanding, it was essentially like parts that were getting water jet and maybe some of the machine. I'm actually not sure exactly what all went into.
I believe it was profiles and holes and maybe counterbores were what originally Ken Onion did. He did hand ground blades. They even were hand rubbed blades. I think they were still hand contoured scales. All that was still being done by hand. It was basically just the profiling and the holes and the, you know, that sort of stuff.
By today's standards, would 99.999% of people would consider a custom.
Oh yeah.
Like that's, you know, so it's evolved, and as it's evolved, it's just, like you said, it's become more muddy. The lines have become a lot more blurred, and there's lots of in between, you know, and none of it is wrong. Except having your stuff made in China.
I mean, it is weird.
I do feel like that's wrong, but you know, hey.
It's weird for me to be, you know, like sort of compared to the guy who's, you know, got a CNC in his shop. In the same way, it would be weird to compare the guy with a CNC in his shop to your company, you know, or it would be weird to compare your company to Benchmade or Spyderco or, you know, whatever else. So like it creates some weird things where, you know, I'm still considered a custom maker and he's still considered a custom maker, but we don't do things the same way.
You do completely different things. Yeah. Right. And what it boils down to is that you're using different tools.
Yeah.
You know, like it's, you know, so it's kind of, you know, if you backed it way up, it'd be like the difference between somebody, you know, flint knapping, you know, obsidian blades or whatever versus somebody grinding, you know, high speed steel and making knives out of that, you know. Yeah. So both are still technically custom makers, but they're, you know, they're making different things.
Yeah.
And so what I feel like is the most important is transparency and education. All right. And I feel like the onus is on both sides of it. I think it's up to the maker to be completely transparent and put out there what they do and how they do it and all that, which is one of the reasons why I post so many videos of work going on inside our shop and stuff, because I want people to know. And I talk about, hey, we're waiting on parts from the water jet, or, you know, hey, we just bought a double disc grinder, so we're not having to have that done anymore. Like, basically, people are following along as our as our stuff changes, people are following right along and basically staying up to date with how we do things.
Yeah.
And that's the way I feel like is the right way to do it, is to put that out there. That being said, there's also responsibility on the customer side to look into these things and pay attention when you buy something and know what you're getting. Like if the person's not putting that information out there and you buy it thinking it's a custom and it's technically like a, basically a glorified mid-tech or even a production knife, basically what, you know, which is definitely happening now too. Then that's, if they didn't put the information out there and you bought it anyway for custom prices and it's basically a production, you can't get mad later because you didn't do, you took the risk because, you know, you didn't do your homework. Not saying it was right for them to not be transparent, but you have to take some of the responsibility as a customer too, to know what you're buying. So, you know, you, both sides need to be, if somebody's not being transparent and you can't get them to answer, you ask them a question and you, they won't give you the answer to it, then if you still buy the product, that's on you. You know, if you, you get what you get, and down the road, if you decide that you, you paid too much because you essentially bought a glorified production, then that's, you know, should have looked into it a little bit more.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the big sticking points with this whole conversation is like, there's sort of a price gauge, you know, that sort of swings and, you know, like, sorry, got a cat. you know, like, you know, you sort of expect the handmade, the custom, the one-off, the very low quantity to be, you know, low supply, high demand, you know, high price. And then, you know, you expect it to sort of fall down from there, but you know, that's not always the case in terms of, you know, there's some production companies that have the capability of, you know, pumping out very large numbers and, you know, but they still keep their prices at, you know, higher than some of those other price categories. And it's sort of just a weird landscape that we're in right now where we've got.
It is, because there's essentially like high end production knives that are maybe coming from companies that are that also produce essentially customs or whatever. And then, but then some of the prices on the production essentially almost match what's on the customs. And I know I heard from somebody that was at a show recently that said that, you know, they were basically, there was somebody there that was one of the companies there was, you know, pulling out knives that were obviously production knives. Cause like every time they'd sell one, they'd just put it back out on the table, you know, grab another one and put it on the table. And it was, and I think they were like $1,900 or something, which in most people's, you know, perspective, I think would consider, I mean, not too many, unless they got really high end materials or something, that's not a, not probably considered a production knife.
Yeah. Part of that but, price is to have something unique, is have something sort of, you know, special, but.
But at the same time, you can make the argument that, I mean, depending on what kind of numbers they're making in these knives and when it, you know, then they are still, you know, even though it may be, you know, a few thousand versus, you know, less than 100 or something like that, it still comes down to the buyer. If it's worth it to the buyer to pay $1,900 for that, no matter how it was made, then that's what the knife is worth. Like, you know, that's as long as they, my only issue is making sure that people know what they're buying. Like if you knowingly buy something that, you know, is a say small batch production or whatever, and you pay $1,900 for it, it's, then it's worth $1,900 to you. I mean, if that's what you're willing to pay for it to have it, then hey,
you
that's
pull
great.
That money out of your wallet, you know,
I'm not, hey, I'd love to sell some for $1,900. You know, that's, I'm not going to complain about that, but as long as people know what they're doing, that that's another thing while we're touching on that subject is because I see people all the time, you know, the so-called experts online, and I'm talking about like customers, like armchair quarterback, and, you know, oh, such and such brand, such and such, this knife isn't worth that, and that knife's worth that. It's all relative, guys. It's all subjective. If people are willing to pull the money out of their pocket or whatever, or swipe their card, and they they're going to pay that money for it, then it's worth it. Like, it might not be to you, but it's worth it to somebody if they're selling them. So I don't know of any knife companies that I've seen that are, you know, holding people at gunpoint to pay them for their knives. So it's, you know, it's, if the market bears it, then it's not wrong as far as that goes. You may think it's overpriced, but if other people are buying them and they're buying enough of them for the people to continue to afford to be able to, the company can afford to make them and sell them at that price without losing money, then it's not overpriced.
Yep.
It's just overpriced for you. And there's tons of things out there that are overpriced for me and in all industries.
Yep.
I mean, Lord, I look at stuff all the time, gun stuff and, you know, vehicles and everything else that I'm like, oh, that's cool. I think I might like to have that. And then I look at it and I'm like, see the price. And I'm like, well, it is really cool, but it's just not worth that to me to buy that.
Not that cool.
But you know what I don't do when that happens? I don't get online and make a nasty comment about the company and how they're overpriced.
Yeah.
I don't shoot them an email and act like a jackass and tell them that, you know, your stuff's overpriced or whatever. Like, I'll never understand that mindset. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to the original topic. Everything is very blurred right now. And I feel like the solution to it is transparency from the maker / company and homework by the buyer.
Yeah. And
I
need to do a better job. I think you do a really good job of that. You know, always doing those sort of walkthrough videos where, you know, you're like, this machine's running handles, this one's running blades, you know, he's over here sharpening blades, he's over here fitting handles up. And, you know, like, I think you do a good job of that. And I need to do a better job of sort of informing my customer base that, you know, how I do things, which I do sometimes when I feel like it's something interesting. It's just, sometimes that's hard as far as content creation. When you do something every day, it doesn't feel as interesting, you know, to put out there.
Right.
Like, but.
Which is exactly what I was thinking when you were saying that about what I do. Like, I hesitate a lot of days when I'm like, am I really going to go just, you know, film the CNC running and coolant going everywhere and you can't half see what's going on in there again and put it on there?
Yeah.
But number one, people like it. It gives you content. It makes people feel like they're a part of, you know, getting to see behind the scenes, get to, you know, look behind the curtain, and it's transparency. It shows, you know, okay, this is what's being done in our shop. This is, you know, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
So people can have a pretty good idea of, I mean, you could go back a lot of those are on my story, so I guess they disappear. But if you watch my account very closely, you'll know pretty much how we do things, what we do and don't do in house and all that, just from listening and watching to the videos.
Yeah.
So, and that's, you know, that helps me sleep at night. That lets me not worry about, you know, that way people know what they're getting, you know, and if that's cool with them, then that's great. You know,
yeah.
If it's not, and we're not for them, then that's fine too.
Yeah.
There are people that only want to buy full customs and stuff like that. That's totally fine.
Yeah. There's some people that don't buy anything, you know, that unless they're an ABS member, or, you know, on the other side, there's some people that only buy from guild members and, you know, like,
right,
you know, on the custom side. And, you know, some people only want custom slip joints. Some people want custom fixed blades. Like, there's a whole thing out there, but I don't know.
I tell you another layer that's kind of along with this that even sometimes I kind of struggle with nailing down is so when you get into like production stuff, say like what we're doing.
Can you get a little closer?
Yep. Sorry. I'm trying to not be too big and bold in the camera here, but it's also getting me away from the microphone.
Yep.
So don't want to hurt these people's eyes too much on YouTube here. But anyway, like the difference between like small batch production and like big batch production, that kind of stuff, you know,
because
like a lot of what we're doing is very similar to what bigger companies are doing. Mm-hmm. It's just that they've got a whole lot more machines and a whole lot more people doing it.
Yeah.
You know, so it just, a lot of it just comes down to volume. I think some of it changes. I know some of the companies are using, you know, robots and stuff like that for some of the different processes. So, you know, I think it would be kind of hard to argue that if you're using robots and stuff, and I'm not saying that's wrong. We may very well at some point for some processes, who knows, we may have want some to load and unload pallets off machines or whatever.
Those are super
automated
cool
to some extent.
Yeah.
But I think it would be hard for, at that point, it would be hard for us to argue that we're a small batch, you know, kind of boutique kind of production shop and not full on, you know, large scale production. You know? So it just depends. But at the same time, you could have two machines and have a robot loading them, unloading them, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, still pretty small. You're just streamlining it. And
yeah.
So like, just, there's so much nuance to it.
I don't, DFM EDC. He's the guy that does the podcast with, Alex Steingrabber. He's got some sort of robot that loads and unloads his pallets. And yeah. I think he's still a single man operation. You know,
right.
He's so got a knife design now, but I don't think knives are his typical stock and trade, but,
you right. know,
like that.
So it would be hard to argue that he's a full on production shop as one guy
yeah.
that has a robot loading and unloading the machine.
Yeah.
You know, so there's no right answer to if you do this, then you're in this category.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's sort of my point.
Maybe you could come down to volume. And at that point, I also don't know where the line would be there. You know, if you make X number per year is considered small batch. And if you're over that, it's full on large-scale production, where would that number be? Yeah. I have no idea
because I've seen the people. Yep. I've seen people argue that, you know, like Chris Reeve is not production, and I've seen people argue that Chris Reeve is production. And, you know,
right.
you know, you mentioned last week that, like, you know, the number of employees and the amount of stuff that Chris Reeve has is, you know, pretty far out compared to you and your company.
Right.
And so, like, you know, where does that put you in that situation? So, like,
right.
You know, there's some people I'm sure that would consider your knives production. I wouldn't necessarily do that, but, you know, I know a little bit more about the process, but, you know, it's all sort of subjective, and that's the problem, I think. And it's not necessarily a problem to me. I mean, call it what you want, the transparency thing and, you know, knowing how it's made, I think is the important thing.
Right. Exactly. As long as you know how it's made, it doesn't really matter what label you want to put on it. Like, I always worry when other people are putting labels on it, and then people are taking their information from that. You know what I mean? Like, they make assumptions based on a label when the labels don't always mean the same thing to different people.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm, you know, where I see the problem. Other than that, like I said, as long as people know, and like, I consider us production, but I consider us small batch production, almost like boutique kind of production or whatever. So, because even in the big companies, they still have people in there doing handwork, fitting stuff up, polishing stuff, doing, you know what I mean? Like this, a lot of the same processes are still taking place. And I personally, this is not, you know, just my opinion, but like for Chris Reeves knives, I would consider them kind of on the upper end of small batch production.
Yeah.
Like I feel like that's probably, and I don't even know exactly how many knives they put out a year, but I would think that probably they're kind of walking the line somewhere between like small batch and full on just, you know, large scale production.
Yeah.
That's just my opinion. And they may put out less than I think. And if so, then they might not be as close to the line as I think. But again, who determines where the line is?
Yeah.
You know,
that's the thing.
Is 5,000 knives a year the line? Is 10,000? Is 100,000? You know, where's, I don't think anybody would argue that 100,000 knives a year is small batch.
No.
So
I wouldn't, but you know,
somewhere between there and one is probably the number, but I don't know where it is.
To Victorinox, who, you know, basically has 6,000 finished knives a day or something like that.
Right.
That may be considered
100,000 would seem small.
Yeah. So, you know, it's all relative. I think like, Victorinox used to have something on their website, like it was a banner up at the top. It was like, you know, 6,000 knives per day, you know, like just a ridiculous number. That's crazy to think about.
Just blows my mind.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, when I think about how many we make per day now compared to what we did just a few months ago, it kind of blows my mind. But that's a whole another scale beyond the scale there. So,
yeah,
that's wild. So basically the answer is we don't have an answer.
Yeah.
I think the answer is don't worry too much about labels and don't make assumptions based on labels and look into what the company does. I feel like there's so many companies out there. This is starting to get into a little bit of a different topic, but there's so many companies out there. We're lucky enough in this industry to have options of where we want to spend our money. Not many of us have the luxury of just having unlimited money to spend. So I feel like it's a good idea to spend your money wisely as far as what you want, but also who you want to support. So you not only get a product that you like the product, but you feel good about buying it because you know you supported somebody that is got the same kind of values and stuff that you do.
Yeah.
So I think that by just looking at all the way, you know, that looking at how the process is done, you're probably also going to kind of get a peek. If you pay enough attention to know how somebody's building something, you're probably also getting a good enough look at them to kind of figure out if their values align with yours. And then you can make an informed decision and feel good about your purpose and not really worry about the labels.
Yep.
That's how I see it.
I agree.
So final word is there's no final word.
Yeah, basically. And just, yeah, don't necessarily take labels at face value just because, you know, YouTube reviewer or, you know, even a buddy of yours is like, hey, you know, it's a production knife. I mean, that, you know, doesn't necessarily
just
mean,
to throw a,
you know,
just
anything.
To throw a shot across the bow. Half the time, the YouTube reviewers don't know what you're talking about anyway.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
I don't really know that much about. I don't know. I think they may have a couple of employees, or they may be still doing.
I wasn't going to go there, but anyway.
Yeah. Oh, I will.
So, yeah, just so. I would say don't make assumptions based on the label that's given to it by somebody else.
Look for yourself.
Yeah, decide for yourself. But
anyway. All right, what we got? What we got next? We got some customer or viewer topics / questions.
Yeah. We're going to discuss some compound grinds this week, but you want to put that off till next week?
Since we're running since we kind of rambled so long on that, which that was a pretty deep topic we were just talking about.
Yeah, I probably
shouldn't
have tried to include both of those. So, yeah, we'll just...
I'll be honest with you. I'm probably not going to have a ton of input on the compound grinds, but we'll still put it out. We'll tease it for next week.
Yeah, so next week we'll talk about some compound grinds a little bit and, you know, get into that. So on to some questions.
All right.
From Jerome, also known as Monarch EDC on Instagram, he asked about sharpening, if we like mirror edges or toothy edges. And I know your answer, but what do you think?
I like toothy edges. I do not like mirror edges really at all. I mean, they maybe look cool in pictures or whatever, but from an actual, like, I'm the kind of person that's always used their stuff, and, you know, I've used knives pretty much daily for something, even if it's just opening Amazon boxes or whatever. But like, I've used knives, you know, from being a, you know, hunting, fishing, in the Marine Corps, everything else. Like, I've cut everything from, you know, boxes to rope to, you know, skin, animal skin, but, well, maybe a couple of human skins here and there accidentally,
including
but
your
we
own.
Won't get into that.
Speaking of which, I saw had some blood in the shop this week.
That was Luke, actually. Oh. I posted it. I think people probably assumed that it was mine, but this, thankfully, it wasn't mine this time. It was. Mm. I probably wouldn't have had the moxie to post it if it had been me. I'd have probably been over there whining somewhere. But, you know, Luke, he was just closing a knife, and somehow, like, he said he was it closed, and it was dropping shut, and his thumb, it started to hit his thumb, and he, like, tried to pull his thumb out of the way, but when he did, he actually, like, pulled it up the blade instead of, like, straight away from it. It got him. I mean, he was gushing blood. He had already tried to patch it up when they came and told me, and it was still bleeding through the bandages. And so we went in there and took it off, kind of let him hold it, squeeze it shut, wiped it off, and I put super glue on it and squeezed it shut again without trying to glue our fingers to it. And we got it to pretty much stop bleeding. But yeah, he was gushing. So
yeah,
they will cut.
Yeah.
So
on the note of,
and that's kind of, that's a good point, because most of those kind of things, most of the things that you're cutting in real life like that, a toothier edge is going to cut better.
Yeah.
Like, for, I mean, most people are not intentionally cutting flesh unless you're dressing a deer or something like that. A toothy edge works much better on flesh for clean game, stuff like that. If you're some super cool, you know, shadow operative, then, you know, all kinds of flesh, it works better.
Yeah, I mean,
but
there's certain purposes that, you know, require, you know,
right.
But just about any type of edge will work for that. It's soft enough, but, you know, to deal with abrasives like rope and cardboard, which has, you know, silica in it, which is, you know, sand and, you know,
right.
Like, you know, for those type of things, I generally prefer not quite as toothy as you. I generally prefer something, you know, 600 to 1,000 grit, somewhere in there, more of a refined toothy edge, I guess I would say. But I don't necessarily go full mirror. I don't even have the, you know, I don't have the patience nor the equipment for that, frankly. Like, you know, I think the highest rated stone I have is 2,000 or something like that, and that's not what a lot of people say is a true mirror. Like, some of these guys go up to 10,000, you know, and then, like, down to 0.1 micron, and I'm like,
yeah,
you know, I just,
And that's cool as a like thing in and of itself. But again, like I've seen like more mirror polished edges and stuff. You take something that's like I said, rope or something like that, they'll almost like slide. It'd be so polished that they almost slide off of it.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have
before it cuts it
enough teeth to grab. I mean, that's what you're, you know, that's what the edge is. It's a bunch of, you know, basically like saw teeth. And so like it gets to a point of diminishing returns.
Right. Exactly. And so you want to, it's essentially like looking at, you know, like you take, most people are familiar with serrated edges, you know, and how they cut versus a standard edge. And a toothy edge on a normal edge is basically just a microscopic version of a serrated blade.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, you're always, even the most polished one is still going to have some teeth to it, but the more polished it is, the less like individual little teeth there are. And the more of just a solid edge there is. And like you said, you, for most cutting purposes, you want something that's going to grab a little bit. And, you know, just like a serrated edge kind of pulls the teeth, kind of pull the blade into the cut or pull the material into the, into the cut. And that's what those little micro serrations do, depending on how toothy you make the edge. So
definitely
it's yeah. So like you said, yours is at 600 to 1,000. We go to a 220 and then a strop with some green rouge that knocks the burr off and it polishes it a little bit, but it's essentially a 220 grit edge.
Yeah.
So,
which I mean, I could be wrong on this. I think green is the green we use, not jeweler's green, but green compound is roughly around 6,000 grit, but that's not a true 6,000 grit.
No, edge. It's not. No, not at
it's
all.
It's just a, you know, burnishing more than anything.
Yeah, it's polishing it up a little bit, but it's not enough to take. Yeah, it's not changing the actual grit or whatever
striation
that
pattern. So, yeah,
yeah.
I was trying to find the word.
There you go. That sounded good.
Yeah.
So so that's where that's kind of where I fall on that. I definitely prefer the toothier edge, and it's
yeah, me too.
It's so more next aggressive question. Cutting and that kind of stuff.
Oh, sorry. What?
No, I was just saying it just kind of allows to me for like more aggressive cutting and
yeah, I think it's
and that kind of stuff. So
I think it's, you know, I sort of equate it to, you know, trying to like choose something in the middle. I don't want it like super coarse where it's just good for cutting rope or anything, but like I don't want it like to just be able to cut newspaper print either. I want something in the middle.
Right.
And, you know, be able to use it for a lot of different things. That's the joy of a knife is the versatility of the tool. So we had one that was question for Jonathan. This one actually came in from the email list.
Awesome.
Email. You mentioned last episode that you're into some business podcasts, and they were wondering if you had any recommendations.
Oh, yeah. So probably the biggest one that has helped me is it was a podcast that was, it went for several years and then they kind of changed the name and changed the format of it. And it still, it kind of exists, but it's a little different now, but they're actually bringing back the original, just strictly business based content here within just the next few weeks from what they said. So, it's called the MFCEO, Andy Frisella. And I would highly encourage you. So the podcast now is currently called Real AF. And if you go back far enough on the podcast, though, if you go back to the very beginning episodes of the podcast, it's actually the MFCEO episodes for the first 2 or 3 years worth.
Yeah.
And it may have even been 4 or 5 years. And there's tons of good, like just fantastic business content there. And then, and even just good life content. Like you can learn to be, you can learn a lot of stuff in that podcast that will teach you to be good in business, good as an employee in business, you know, and a lot of stuff that will help you just in life in general. But they have said that they're bringing it back. I think it's going to be on an app this time and not just hosted on, you know, the normal platforms or whatever, partially because they've dealt with a whole lot of censorship and stuff because of some of the stuff they talk about on the newer version of the podcast. So they're, anyway, so the MFCEO is coming back as more primarily business related and not, they've gotten doing more current events and some stuff like that over the last 2 or 3 years, but they're going to open it back up to the MFCEO project. So that's one of the best ones that I could encourage you to listen to. You can literally earn millions of dollars from listening to that podcast if you listen and apply. So there's several other ones. The other one, that's the main one that I've listened to consistently over the years. Alex Hormozi is a great resource. Some of his stuff, he's one of those people that's so smart and rattles stuff off so quick that some of it's kind of almost above my, over my head, and I don't think I absorb all of it. And a lot of it, depending on what business you're in too, because his is a lot of like sales related and stuff, and you know, which applies to our business, but we also do manufacturing, yeah, which is kind of a completely different animal. So
yeah,
for really more sales based stuff, Alex Hormozi is a great resource. So I'll try to come up with a couple more to maybe mention on some other podcasts, but that's the MFCEO one is by far and away the main one that I've listened to that I feel like I've gotten the most benefit out of, for sure. So
I know you turned me on to that one whenever I worked for you, and you know,
yeah,
I listened to it back in the day and stuff, but yeah.
And I think it's going to be really interesting to, because Andy has said before, like some of the stuff that he was talking about back then, because I mean, some of that point was, I guess some of those earliest ones was probably close to 10 years ago.
Oh, really?
And from the very beginning, yeah, MFCEO to now. And, you know, some of his, I think, views and opinions on stuff has changed some. So I'm really anxious to see some of the updated information he puts out with the new version of the MFCEO to see if, you know, how some of it's changed, you know what I mean? Like, or evolved really to, yeah, you know, he said, I've heard him, they do Q&A on their current podcast. They do basically like current events, and they have other episodes that are Q&A and stuff, which is similar to the MFCEO content.
Yeah.
And I've heard him say before, you know, that some of his outlooks on stuff has evolved some, and you can tell from some of his answers on there. So I'm really looking forward to continuing to learn with that, but yeah, that's, I'd highly recommend that.
And that was from Paul Girard, by the way. So I forgot to
mention. Good question, Paul. Thank you.
Yeah. And one thing I've been meaning to mention, I apologize to you listeners out there for my constant sniffling. It's something that's lingering around and won't go away, so I just apologize. I try to not do it in the microphone, but I just did it, so I apologize.
Doesn't seem nearly as obnoxious as my cough has been, so
well,
we'll forgive you.
All right. Last question for the day, and this one's a good one as well. This is from @DungeonsAndDrafts on Instagram. With the market as flooded as it is, how do you create designs that are original? So, I guess
that is a really good question, and I'm going to let you go first.
yeah, I was going to take the lead since you took the lead the other two times, but
yes, please.
Yeah, don't even know where to start with that one. It's very difficult, especially starting out, because, you know, there's, especially, you know, nowadays with the production companies coming out with, you know, 5 new designs just about every month or 2 months or so, and they're just constant deluge of new, and even some of these companies, you know, sort of, especially the Chinese companies, sort of infringe a little bit on their, you know, other stuff that's already out there. So it's the lines between, oh, that's this maker, or this designer's lines, or, you know, stuff like that is very difficult to navigate these days. Mainly for me, I guess I just kind of, I've got influences of, you know, like Jesper Voxnes is one of my favorite designers. Like, I like Sinkovich. I like a lot of the European and sort of overseas, European mostly designers that sort of have that, I don't know, industrial look to them. So I kind of try to marry that a little bit with, you know, some of my other influences of, you know, Jonathan. I like, you know, sort of Les George's style. I like, you know, a lot of other guys where it's sort of more organic as well as industrial, and trying to marry those two things. So I guess, yeah, it's very difficult. And mainly it's sort of combining lines in ways that sort of make up your style. It's not necessarily that any particular lines are entirely my lines. It's just combining them in different ways to sort of create something new. So what do you think?
Yeah, pretty much the same. I mean, I think how you do it is basically keep your eraser handy or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, or in my case, doing it on computer, have the eraser function ready to or to
undo button,
scrap it and move on.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you'll do something and then I can't tell you how many times I've, especially back in the days, like I'll be honest, I don't sit down and just like draw a bunch of designs kind of like for fun or whatever. At this point, I probably should more. I just kind of like you were talking about earlier with the being busy with stuff. Like I just, you know, by the time I sit down and I'm done with work, I'm not necessarily, you know, when I know I've got some stuff, I get a itch to, for a new project or something, then, you know, I'll sit down and design some stuff. But back in the day when I was sitting around and that was, you know, I didn't have as many people buying my knives and stuff. I wasn't as busy. So I was spending a lot of time. Plus it was all just new, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was trying to come up with designs and it seemed like so often I would draw something up and I'd be just super happy. Oh man, this is going to be great. And within like a few hours or a day or two, I'd be scrolling through the internet or something and I'd be like, well, crap.
Yep.
And I'd just come on something I'd never seen before. You know, it's not like I had it in my head and that's where I got it from. But some design, it maybe even be like somebody like, you know, they're just debuting their brand new design or something. And it's like 2 days after I drew something and it looks very similar. And I'm like, well, crap.
Yeah.
Like I'm not putting that out in the world now. So, that one goes back in the drawer or garbage can or whatever. So,
yeah.
I mean, some of it is just being willing to move on. If you do something, you know, you design something and it comes out not as different as it needs to be from other stuff. You just gotta, I mean, you can go try to change it or sometimes just be willing to just let it go and move on and design something else.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's happened to me multiple times, like to
me too.
Be like, okay.
And even like yeah. I've tried to take existing designs, especially in CAD, it's kind of easy to do this where you take an existing design right. And then you start messing with all the lines and stretching stuff out and moving it around.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, that looks great. And then you're like, oh, wait, so-and-so makes that knife. And
right.
I've done that a few times where I've, you know, tried to modify current existing design, and by using those, you know, 10 lines or less, I end up coming out with a completely different knife that somebody else has already made. And
yep.
So it's just a really difficult thing. And, you know, you try to conduct yourself with integrity and try not to step on any toes, but also, you know, try not to, you know, take it too personally when someone gets close. I mean, there's knockoffs and then there's somebody getting, you know, designing something similar or, you know, in the same yeah. vein.
Which in most cases is just, it's just that we're all trying to design tools that function a certain way mm-hmm. that fit in the human hand
yep.
and are made to be used a certain way. And like, there are going to be similarities. Yep. Like that's just all there is to it, you know?
Yep.
So, I mean, there's some stuff that comes out, you know, that's just completely outside the box. And even more rarely there's stuff that comes out outside the box that's actually good and like useful and not just, you know, different for the sake of being different.
Yeah.
You know, every now and then somebody will really put something, you know, cool and useful and, you know, like I said, not just different for the sake of being different, but for the most part, they're all similar with just slight little twists on the lines and,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the ratios and all that stuff. So it's just, yeah, it's a lot of it is just, it's trial and error. It's being willing to just keep tweaking stuff and playing with it until you get something that, and then you get feedback on it. And, you know, people like certain stuff about it, don't like certain stuff about it. You know, you figure out if what they're saying resonates with you. And if it's, you know, no, I think the design should be, I like it the way it is, so I'm not going to change it. Or,
yeah.
you know what? They're right. That might look better if I did that. So like, being willing to revise and stuff as you go as well can be important to that.
Yeah.
So
that's the other thing is like, you know, just because you designed it once doesn't necessarily mean the design is done. You know?
Yeah.
You can definitely,
usually it's not.
yeah. Generally you just set it down and, you know, come back in a day or three and, you know, check it again and be like, oh, what was I doing?
but yep.
I need to follow my own advice there a lot more than I do, but yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'll get so excited when I design something new. I'm just like, oh, I want to go make it right now. Like, let's go do this.
Yeah.
But
well, like we've talked about, that is kind of the exciting part of it, is bringing that out of your head to actual real, you know.
Real tangible object.
Tangible object. It's, yeah.
Right, that was neat.
So, but yeah, that that's a good question and one that we really don't have a great answer to. It's just,
yeah.
Like I said, trial and error. I mean, I don't know of any one way to just, you know, number one, to make it completely original, you'd have to be aware of every other thing that's out there.
That was sort of my point,
too. To know that you're making it different from that, and that's basically impossible.
Yeah, like there's so much stuff out there these days.
Right.
I would say impossible to literally know every single knife out there. You may think you know, and at one point I thought I knew. But I mean, there's even entire sectors of the knife world that, like, you know, you don't even know of or think of, or, you know.
Yep.
So
all these little subcategories and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's so much out there, which is a great thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does make it hard to be, you know, to be original and stuff with the designs. Mm-hmm. I think part of the other thing is once you get a design that you feel like is original enough to you, you know, that it's just being patient and being willing to promote it and give it time to get out there and see if people actually resonate with it. And if it's, you know, something that they agree it's different enough or whatever. So you can't just do something and think, you know, oh, this is cool, this is different or whatever, throw it out there and expect it to just be a hit instantly. Mm-hmm. At least that's never been the case for me.
Yeah.
But
I definitely need to keep that in mind more as well. So
yeah, a lot of times it just has to get out there and marinate and, you know, and circulate and get enough feedback. And it's super, super, super easy for us as, you know, creators to create something. You get a little bit of feedback on it. And if it's negative feedback or whatever, like you can go either way. You can very quickly feel like the whole world's on your side. Everybody loves it. Or you can feel like that it's everybody hates it based off of one or two comments.
Yep.
You know, like it's really easy to get in your own head about, you know, that this is the way it is. And this is the public's opinion of it.
Yeah.
Just based off of one or two comments and, you know, one or two comments that may or may not even actually mean anything. So it's tough. That's one of the hardest parts of that. And then coming up with the original name for them. That's two of the hardest things. Just, you know, it's not that hard to just design a knife that you like the looks of it yourself, but then trying to make sure that it's original and not too close to other things. That's where the challenging part comes in for sure.
Yep.
So,
all right. So with that, I know you said you had some, got the Dixon parts in and were kind of working on a little
prototype.
Bit. I saw they were surface grinding earlier the week.
Yep. I'm going to try to, I'm going to start with the handles because the blades, I've got something, a new piece of equipment that we're going to be mounting on that I'll talk about more soon, that I'm going to be mounting on the mill that we do the blades on. And I haven't figured out yet if I'm going to have to move my existing pallet base that's going to stay on there where I need to run the blade blanks. So what we do, just to break it down, so what we do typically is, well, we do it two ways. The main knives that we do and what we're going to try to be doing going forward is essentially having the knives that are being ground, not the ones that we mill on the machine, but the ones that are being ground. We basically take the blanks, put all the features on them besides the bevels, and then they go to heat treat, and then they go get ground, right? And then they come back to us for fitting and stuff. So that's still going to kind of be the process, except I'll just go ahead and at least say this. We're working on trying to figure out how to do the grinding ourselves. So it'll still be the same process, but it'll be a different setup for the grinding. So we have to have one setup for doing all the features, you know, putting the holes in it, putting the jimping in it, profiling it, all that good stuff. And then at that point, and it gets cut out. And at that point, it's a working blade minus the bevels. And so the pallet that I need to do that on may have to move because of the new piece of equipment that we're going to mount. And you don't want to ideally, you don't want to create a pallet on a base and then move it because when you put it back on, even if you dial it in the best you can, it's probably not going to be exact.
Yeah.
This was a hard lesson that I learned early on about this kind of stuff, because I made a lot of mistakes because of that kind of stuff.
I was there during that learning time. And
yes, yeah, you know. Yeah. So props to Les George for straightening me out on some of that. So, long story short, I'm not quite ready to do the blaze yet until I look at this new piece of equipment and see whether I'm going to have to move my existing pallet base some for everything to fit right.
Yeah.
So rather than go ahead and essentially waste a pallet by making a pallet and then potentially having to move it and start over, I'm going to start with the handles and get them going. And then hopefully within the next day or two, by early next week at the latest, I should be able to start on the blades. And then, depending on how much trouble the handles give me, I could also still be struggling with getting the handles right by first of next week. So we'll see.
Yeah. I know you're doing something different for the handles too. So that could be a interesting challenge as well. So
It should be very, very similar. Most of the stuff's very similar, aside from the fact that they're going to be contoured versus just flat like the
I didn't know
Mac
if you would
2,
announce that, you know. So I wasn't going to say it. So
yeah, okay. Well, I figure people could kind of, if they look closely, they could tell from the video. Yeah. I figured on the 3D model. So, and I think a couple of people had asked me in my comments. So yeah, these handles will be like fully contoured handles, not super, super, you know, deep or whatever you want to call it, but they will be, they will definitely not be just flat with rounded edges. So, haven't done that on folder handles yet, but we have fully contoured fixed blade handles in G10 and stuff on the machine. So in theory, it should be basically the same thing, just with different speeds and feeds and stuff. So
yeah,
hopefully that doesn't cause too many issues, but
yeah,
then we've got to think about processes like pressing the detent ball in that's done after the, after the fact. So I've already kind of, I think, come up with an idea to be able to do that.
Yeah.
To press a detent ball in, even though the handle's not flat.
Yeah.
So yes, that's what I've got going on, is basically continuing to prep for Texas. Got a couple of specialish things that we're trying to get done, and then try to get this Dixon prototype so we can get rolling on it very quickly.
Nice.
So you're still hammering down on Texas, I assume?
Yeah, still on Texas. Still working on my 5 fleets, my anniversary sets, and
yeah,
got 2 of the fixed blades glued up and ready for contouring, and then I've got the other 3 ready for contouring. I think I've got all the blades ground on the folders as well, and I think I got all the locks set too, and locks and detents.
So good.
I'm moving along. I even got a couple of them.
Yeah.
I got one contoured fully, and then I've started the chamfering processes on the others. So.
Yeah, it sounds like you're making pretty good progress. That's great.
Yeah, I sort of kicked it into overdrive, man. Like, I don't know what happens, why I can't be this productive all the time, but, like, especially when it gets close to blade show time, I go Super Saiyan knife maker sort of thing, and I don't even know if you get that reference, but...
Pressure.
Yeah, that. But, yeah, it just...
The trick is learn to put pressure on yourself all the time.
Yeah, and, well, the problem is...
And not have a heart attack.
It's... Once I finally kind of let go and stop worrying about it is when I'm most productive. If I'm sitting there worried about it, I'm like, okay, while this is set up, I've got to go do this and this and this and this, instead of just being, you know, doing it. And then
just do it. Once it gets out of your head,
then worrying about what's next. That's usually where my problem runs in, is overthinking, like sort of that paralysis by analysis, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'll be like, okay, while I'm set up to do, you know, while I'm set up to drill detents, I need to get all these detents drilled and, you know, do that instead of just get the first one done and then worry about what you got to do next. Like, that's what generally helps me, is I just kind of go into a state of like, okay, which one are you, you know, what am I doing next? And that generally helps me.
Just taking action.
Yeah.
Yep.
Stop thinking about it.
So on that note, go ahead and remind everybody what your table number is at the show.
Yes. And I was going to mention that we're 19 days away, by the way. It's just, we're under 20.
19 days.
Yeah. And
I'm actually pretty excited and looking forward to it. I'm not that, like, stressed out. I'm kind of to the point, like, the stuff that may not get done is stuff that, like, if it doesn't, it doesn't. It's not that big of a deal. So we'll see. I'm more worried about potentially having the Dixon prototype ready. So anyway, so your table number.
With an empty table, mostly. But, you know.
Yeah.
That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
So I will be at table 10K and hopefully not with an empty table, hopefully with five stacked knives and maybe some other goodies along. Oh, there was one thing I wanted to mention. A maker named Broken Anvil Knifeworks, a guy named Charlie, he's reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to do he makes these little Damascus beer chips, and I think he does 20 per show. I think he only does it for Texas, but and he basically gives them to 20 different people around the room, and it's sort of a scavenger hunt, I guess, sort of thing, where you go up to that maker's table and either you can ask for the coin and, you know, you get the coin and it's like his handmade Damascus that he's just punched out in a little, you know, they call them beer chips, but they're basically just, you know, sort of coin things.
Right.
And you can either ask for it, come up to my table and ask for it, or if, you know, you just come up to me and start talking to me and I think you're a cool person or, you know, whatever, you know, may give it to you. And, you know, he puts out a list of all the makers that are on his, that he's given them to, and, you know, sort of just a fun thing, you know, that somehow got included in. But yeah,
very cool. Yeah. I always like that kind of stuff. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. And so
your booth number.
Yeah, we will be at booth 309. So please come see us. We're really looking forward to seeing everybody, and this will be a surprise for you as well. But, also Chase and I will each have some,
Hey,
we will have some stickers for the show available at both of our tables, or maybe keep some. I always have good intentions of having stuff in my pocket when I'm walking around and handing them out, but that doesn't always work out the way I want it to. So, but we will for sure have some at our tables and stuff handing them out. So you guys, please come by and get those. Help us promote the show. And on that note, guys, please, we really appreciate it. If you can help us spread the word about the show, please, you know, making comments always helps. Subscribe, like, tell your friends, share it, all that good stuff.
Yep.
It really helps. A lot of this is just us kind of sitting and chatting and talking and whatever, but we are trying to put out some good information that will help educate people in the industry about things, just like the discussion today about the different muddy waters and stuff, blurry lines with the different kinds of manufacturing processes. So I think that some of this information would be beneficial for people, and we're trying to do some of that in pretty much every show. So we'd really appreciate your help with getting this out there and helping us to grow the show.
Yep.
So, well, I guess that about wraps us up for this week.
Yeah, I think so. I don't have anything else. So, on that note, let your freak flag fly.